It's 7 minutes past 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. The G8 summit in Northern Ireland is underway, and the topic of what's ahead for Syria is one of the bigger ones that's on the agenda this week. Our guest this hour says the longer the conflict in Syria continues, the greater the threat it poses. Syria, he says, is in the process of melting down. Andrew J. Tabler is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And we'd like to hear from you, too. If you've got a question or a comment about the Mideast, about Syria for our guest this hour, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are your concerns about what is happening in Syria? Should the U.S. be involved? Should it be more involved than it has been? And what about this idea of selling arms to the rebels there? Is that the direction that the U.S. ought to be taking? And what about Russia's reaction to all of that? You can also post comments to the Joy Cardine Show page on Facebook, and email works too. That address is talk@wpr.org. Andrew Tabler, good afternoon, there we go. Good morning, and welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning.
One of the things I want to start out with is sort of a Syria 101 update for some of our listeners who may not be as conversant with this as you are. The situation in Syria, as we're dealing with it today, essentially started about a little over 2 years ago in what we are now calling the Arab Spring. Can you sort of give us a thumbnail sketch of how we got to where we are right now?
Sure. It's a lot of information to front load. I'll do my best.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the uprising, which began in March 2011, is born out of a previous uprising in Syria in 1982. You have to understand how the Assad regime works a bit. The Assad regime, the Assad family, it has ruled Syria for about 40-some years. They come from a sort of heterodox offshoot of Shia Islam called, they're known as Alawites. The Assads come from that population in Syria. They live on the Syrian coast in the western part of the country, and they make up about 12% of the population. They took power, Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez, took power in a bloodless coup in 1970, for a number of years ruled and stabilized the country. But there was a problem over time. There was an altercation in 1982 between the Muslim Brotherhood, which represents some parts of the majority Sunni population in Syria. Sunnis represent about 75% of the population. As a result of that massacre, the Syrian armed forces under the control of the Assads used artillery to level large parts of the town of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city, and kill between 10 and 30,000 people. Immediately after that crackdown, there was a massive, that suppression of that uprising, there was a massive crackdown in the country, and between 10 and 30,000 people were killed or disappeared. And that crackdown, in one way, shape, or form, went on for about 10 years. The economy contracted, they ran out of hard currency reserves, there were a lot of problems in the country. And, you know, what happens when men and women stay home for long periods of time together, without being able to go outside or in normal life, there was a huge spike in birth rates. In the 10 years following that massacre in 1982, Syria was among the 20 fastest growing populations in the world, like sub-Saharan African levels of reproduction, and perhaps Southeast Asia as well. In any case, it was the people that were born during that time and the aftermath of the previous uprising that are now the ones who are battling against President Assad. At first, they were protesters, peaceful protesters. They demanded reform at first, and then they didn't even demand that President Assad had to leave. And then they started, as the regime began to shoot back, they began to demand the fall of the regime. The regime used lethal, more and more lethal power against them, first from snipers to machine guns to shelling, artillery, cannon fire, fixed-wing aircraft, helicopters, and now they're using Scud missiles. And, of course, the thing that caused President Obama to react, they began using chemical agents. The uprising went armed about a year ago or so, and it's from in a number of these groups who represent the Sunni, largely Sunni and Kurdish parts of Syria. They are the ones who are taking the shots against Assad, and they're the ones who are probably going to be calling the shots in liberated parts of Syria. For now, there is a standoff between the Assad's forces in the west, which include the coast, where they're from, where Alawites are from, and Lebanon and Damascus, and then those in the eastern part of the country, which represent the Sunni and Kurdish population. Unfortunately, in each one of these areas, because of the carnage and the lack of international intervention, we have U.S.-designated terrorist groups that are not only present but ascendant. So in the regime-controlled areas, we have Hezbollah, and they are actively involved in the fight now alongside Assad's troops. In the center of the country, we have Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate. And in the Far East, we have an offshoot of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. So we're going from a situation where Syria as a country, was a sponsor of international terrorism, according to the United States, and now it's being divided into three general parts in which terrorist groups are ascendant.
I want to read you wrote an article that was posted on the Washington Institute website, and I just want to read you the lead. Washington should pursue a measured but assertive course with Syria because the longer the conflict lasts, the greater the threat it poses. So two questions. First of all, if Washington is not pursuing, what kind of course is Washington pursuing, has been pursuing for the last couple of years, and what is that threat that Syria poses if we don't pursue that measured course?
Sure. So far, the United States has backed the protesters at first, and Ambassador Robert Ford, in his visit to the city of Hama when our embassy there was open, and this was in the spring of 2011, pro-American, those supporting the United States shot through the roof. It was very popular. However, over time, what happened is that after President Obama said that President Assad had to step aside in August of 2011, and the United States issued a raft of trade and oil sanctions on Syria. After that, we took a course of diplomacy through the United Nations. The problem is, and this gets us to the Group of Eight meeting that we have going on at the moment, Russia and China have vetoed almost every resolution that the United States and the West have put forward that would lead to a bona fide transition in Syria. The origin of the problem is that for the United States, a transition means the transfer of power from the minority Assad regime to a new group of individuals who hopefully represent the majority in the country. For Russia, a transition of power means President Assad holds on and is allowed to run for re-election in 2014. And for those of you in the audience who aren't familiar with Syrian elections, President Assad won the last one by 97.65% of the vote. It was an election I looked at personally, and of course, voter fraud was the rule. Now, what are U.S. interests in this? It's a good question. Many people have said that the fighting in Syria is akin to that occurred in Lebanon during the Civil War, and there are many parallels with it. Many of the same groups, some of the same leaders. But to use a metaphor, the threat that Syria poses is to the regional security architecture. It's a bit like a block of row houses, and I think those of you who own property can relate to this. I certainly can. The Lebanon War, for as tragic as it was the row house on the end of the block. So it caught on fire. When it caught on fire multiple times, and there were efforts to try and put it out, there were two strong row houses around it, Israel and Syria, that were able to contain the damage to the rest of the block, to the rest of the regional security architecture, and kept it contained. So it was bloody, it was terrible, but it was containable in a larger sense. The problem with Syria is it's the row house in the middle of the block, and that's the reason why the Obama administration and many other administrations engaged Syria over time. Its strength was geography. It borders NATO ally Turkey, Iraq, where we spent billions of dollars stabilizing that country, Jordan, which is a major ally of the United States, Israel, another ally, and, of course, Lebanon. When Syria catches fire and melts down, it's very difficult to contain, and the threat there of that conflict spills into the neighboring row houses and threatens to destabilize a large part of the Middle East, which is home to 65% of the world's oil reserves and 40% of its gas reserves. That can do a variety of things. It not only can lead to U.S. intervention, it can affect gas prices. It can the ramifications of it are endless. There's no end in sight to the conflict for now, and that's why I think that you've seen President Obama shift course hesitantly over the last week and recognize that doing something more outside of the United Nations and outside of just simply issuing sanctions is in order.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we will continue our discussion with our guest about what is happening in Syria and what the future there looks like, particularly with that G8 summit meeting going on in Northern Ireland right now. If you've got a question or a comment for our guest, give us a call at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know? What is your hope for that part of the world? 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 minutes past 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. Wisconsin weather for the day in most parts of the state looks as though it's going to be pretty nice. Sunny and mild conditions. You can expect highs mostly in the low to mid-70s. It'll be in the 60s near the Great Lakes. Tonight, though, looks like it's going to be clear and cool, lows dropping back down into the 40s in some parts of Wisconsin. This hour, we are talking about what is happening in Syria. We've been hearing a lot of news out of Syria lately, and it seems to be coming faster and faster. And right now, G8 summit taking place in Northern Ireland. President Obama is there. Of course, Russian President Vladimir Putin is there, too. And Syria is on the agenda. This hour, our guest is Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And we're talking with him about what is happening in Syria and what the future there looks like. We'd like to hear from you, too. 800-642-1234. Andrew Tabler, before we go to our phones, we've got some callers who would like to join in. One question I have is, you mentioned President Obama making some decisions last week. And, you know, as I'm not an expert, I'm just sort of somebody who reads the news. He seemed very hesitant about this whole thing. You know, he's getting pressure. You know, Senator McCain is over there urging more action. We have the red line. But, you know, it just seemed as though for a long time, I don't know what the term is, but he seemed very hesitant about doing anything. Is that because of the complexity? They weren't sure what to do or what?
Absolutely. If we had a more assertive policy earlier, it would have been easier to shape the opposition that we would like to take power in a post-Assad Syria, right? And that what I mean by more assertive is working more with them, providing more materials, working with them inside the country in border areas of Syria. We didn't do that. We, to use another metaphor, we largely treated the symptoms of the disease, refugees, humanitarian assistance, and so on, which we did a pretty good job of. But we didn't deal with the disease itself. And so what happens is over time that your ability to influence that new Syria, that liberated part of Syria, went down over time. And unfortunately, those who oppose U.S. interests, Al-Qaeda, backed up by a number of contributors from the Arab Gulf and North Africa and beyond, stepped in to help Syrians in their hour of need. And we are now we have a problem that we're going to have to deal with a very fragmented group among the opposition with whom we have little sway at the moment. And we have to understand that anything that we provide must not get into the hands of extremists. So it's very complicated. And I think that is the reason for President Obama's hesitancy beyond his just, I think, very personal proclivity for wanting to keep the United States out of wars in the Middle East. Unfortunately, this war has crept up on us. We didn't go to it, and now we're staring a very long conflict in the face, and one that seems we're going to be involved with for the foreseeable future.
And speaking of problems, so over the weekend, President Obama said we are going to start sending some arms, and relatively immediate reaction from Russian President Vladimir Putin. And then, you know, realizing that 2 days later, they're going to have to be in Northern Ireland at the same conference together.
That's right. It was some very uncomfortable diplomacy. There are lots of different things that are going on, in the sense that we have lots of issues to talk about. We have Iran. We have missile defense. There are lots of different issues we need to speak with the Russians. But if you look at the trend in U.S.-Russian relations, you can see it degrading over time. Syria is one part of that. Unfortunately, I think it's the most acute one, as the U.S. intelligence services, and I think this was the straw that broke the camel's back, finally announced that it was their opinion, along with their allies and their regional allies, that President Assad had used sarin gas. And that violated the red line that was laid down by President Obama in August of 2012, saying that if President Assad used or moved chemical agents, that that would lead to a response by the United States. And that's the crossroads that we're at the moment.
800-642-1234, if you would like to pose a question or if you've got a comment for our guest. Let's go to the phones right now, and we start with Brad, who joins us from Jefferson. Hi.
Hi. I think we'd have far fewer problems like this if we stopped creating blowback. The U.S. can't be the world's policeman while at the same time being the world's weapons dealer. How many of these factions have we backed or helped create that are fighting in this area, whether you're talking about Al-Qaeda, the Mujahideen, Hezbollah? They're all ones that we've helped to create, or Israel has helped to create. I think war's a racket. This is all about profit and power, and I urge people to read Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard.
Brad, thanks for the call. And Andrew Tabler, that is an opinion that you hear a lot these days. I mean, people see what is happening in the Mideast. People see what is happening in Syria. And there is a reaction that the U.S. is doing too much. How can we be a peacekeeper and supply arms at the same time? Those sorts of questions.
Yeah, it's a good question, right? I mean, the problem is that, you know what, we actually haven't created factions in Syria. Some of our allies have, and they've supported them. We haven't created factions. We've really kept our hands off. President Obama was pretty good about that, right? And here's the problem. The problem is that the disease itself, the struggle against the Assad regime, a tyrannical minority ruling over a minority-led regime, ruling over majority Sunni country, this problem isn't going to go away. And it didn't. So what happened is other people stepped in, extremists, to fill the vacuum and to create those factions. And so what we have is Al-Qaeda Iraq's creation of Jabhat al-Nusra and their recent unification of Jabhat al-Nusra with Al-Qaeda Iraq to make the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Now, there's some to-ing and fro-ing in between these two organizations. We're not sure if it's going to go forward, but this is a sign of things to come. Al-Qaeda invested in the Syria conflict, and they have profited marvelously from it. That's not in U.S. interest, trust me. I've been around these people. Those are you that deal with counterterrorism out there in one way, shape, or form. You know how difficult this is. This is something that we need to work against, and the only way to do that is to support those in the Syrian opposition that are not with Jabhat al-Nusra. There are many of them, and we're going to have to work with them because President Assad himself is ruling over only part of the country now. The system's destabilized, and most importantly, he's more beholden to Hezbollah and Iran than ever before, and he's not an ally of the United States. So it's a very complicated situation. I don't blame Americans for being skeptical. We're going to get through this, but it's going to take a lot of very, very careful thinking and watching what's going on the ground and thinking out about what are U.S. interests.
Another level of complexity is posed by John in La Crosse, who emails, in another show it was mentioned that Saudi Arabia is offering help, but only to one side of the conflict. Qatar is offering aid, but only to the other side of the conflict. How is the USA going to offer aid without offending one of our two friends?
Yeah, it's a good another good question. Okay, the United States is not dumping a bunch of weapons or assistance on top of the Syrian opposition and saying, okay, go at it. They are backing what's called the Supreme Military Council. The Supreme Military Council is the armed affiliate of what's called the Syrian Opposition Coalition, or what we call SOC. In Arabic, it's called the Itilef. And the SOC represents those in exile and some of those inside of the country. It's not a terribly effective organization. There are a lot of divisions. They've had a lot of leadership problems. The SMC itself is a group of defectors from the Syrian military and local commanders who are prevalent throughout the country and have relationships with Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And the creation of the SMC last autumn was to work out some of these differences between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Now, the SMC itself is generally a good idea, but for U.S. interests, it's a little bit difficult in that inside of it, you have a number of mainline nationalist figures, defectors from the Syrian military with whom the United States can work, who share our short-term interest of bringing down the Assad regime and our long-term interest of keeping extremists isolated. Inside of the SMC structure, though, there are also Salafists, and some of those Salafists, I postulate, share our short-term interest in Syria, but not necessarily our long-term interest. They would like to create an Islamic State there. They are not the majority of the SMC, but they're present. And so arming the SMC is not going to be an easy thing that we can do in a broad brush fashion. We're going to have to do it in a much more careful way, and I think that has posed a lot of complications for the Obama administration's policy.
We are talking about Syria this hour with our guest, Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. He's got a piece posted, by the way, on the WashingtonInstitute.org site, Syria's Collapse and How Washington Can Stop It. If you're interested in that, check it out. 800-642-1234 is our number if you would like to join in. We'll be taking a break for news. But after that, we'll return to the topic, and we'll be taking your calls. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 25 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9 on Kathleen Dunn, a look at Iran. We continue taking a look at the Mideast here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be discussing the influence of the Supreme Leader there and the country's future domestic and international policies. This hour, we're talking about Syria with our guest, Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. We've got some callers lined up. We'll be getting to those in just a few minutes. We've got one open line left for you at 800-642-1234. Andrew Tabler, before we get to calls, we've been talking a lot about the situation as it's developed and what the U.S. has done or hasn't done over the last couple of years. In the article that I mentioned a few minutes ago, you do lay out a path forward. And I'm wondering, you know, with all the complexities, with all the various layers, with all the implications of everything, where do you start looking for a solution or a series of solutions to something like this?
Yeah, I outlined four steps, and I lined them up as I've been studying this for years, and I lined them up as I saw the different crises gathering force. First, we have to enforce the red line with the Assad regime concerning the use of chemical agents, and the Obama administration is well on its way to doing that. And there we have to hit either their airfields or the bombs in which it's loaded. And if it can't be done safely without killing civilian populations, then we need to hit some of their command and control facilities and enforce that red line. And that's what red lines are. That's in order to keep Syrians from, and this is the bigger problem in Syria, spilling outside of its borders. People who are under threat from Scud missiles and chemical weapons are not going to stay home. Now, half the Syrian population, around 10 million people, are on the run. They're overwhelming Syria's neighbors, many of which are U.S. allies. They can't handle it, and we need to take care of them. And this is step two inside of Syria in safe areas, in border areas of Syria adjacent to Turkey and to Jordan to start out with. These safe areas can be set up with the help of Patriot missiles and what they call offset no-fly zone or aircraft flying over Jordan or Turkey, not aircraft flying over Syria itself. And in step three, and this is the important part, those who are in these safe areas, especially those among the opposition, we're going to have to work with them. And we're going to have to work with them not by boots on the ground, but those using other kinds of footwear, those diplomats and other intelligence agency members who are able to work with those of the opposition and go in and talk with them about what it is that they want and what they need and what to do next. They should do these first from Syrian border regions in Turkey and Jordan, and then over time go into some of the safe areas inside of Syria as security permits. And we don't want to have what happened in Benghazi with the tragic killing of Ambassador Stevens to happen in Syria. And that's step three. Step four, then, is diplomacy. And this is inverting the Obama administration's policy, which put diplomacy first and a solution on the ground second. At the end of this, we need to be able to try and bring all the different factions in the three parts of Syria that I outlined, the regime-controlled areas, the Sunni-controlled areas, and the Kurdish-controlled areas, to bring it back together again. This is diplomacy that could involve Russia. It doesn't have to. It could involve the UN. It doesn't have to. It probably would. This would help try and bring about that political solution. Step four of this diplomatic track, which I'd like to keep open, probably isn't going to happen anytime soon. It's going to be something we need to build towards. But if we build properly towards it and we push the different parties to the negotiating table, I think we can have an outcome where Syria stays in one piece. Hopefully it does. Syria has the largest stockpile of chemical weapons in the Middle East, and we need to make sure that those weapons are kept in safe hands and out of the hands of non-state actors.
You answered part of my question, because I wanted to know, you're laying out the steps and what the time element is. And I'm wondering, do we have the patience for that? I mean, this isn't a process that's going to take place overnight or even over the next year.
Absolutely. It's a crisis that's going to be coming to us. Do we have the patience for it? Would we like to focus on it? No, but the problem is that it continues to spill outside of its borders. The carnage in Syria is an outrage for many of those out there who advocate human rights or just generally concerned in the world, and certainly I would include myself among them. But there are risks that pose with the spillover of the Syria crisis to neighboring countries. It's something that's going to be continuing to come to our doorstep in the form of the growth of, for example, terrorist groups, the chance that those terrorist groups would get chemical weapons in their hands, a whole host of other issues. It's time to start dealing with this now. And if we deal with it now, we deal with the problem and not we deal with the disease and not simply the symptoms, I think we can get this problem to go away. But it's going to be years of effort. And unfortunately, it's going to be much more expensive. Sometimes, even if you didn't break it, you buy into the cleanup to keep things safe.
As you look back, I mean, was there a point in all of this? I mean, and we're dealing with a lot of history here, but is there an earlier point at which the U.S. should have intervened in sort of the way that you're talking about that would have had us in a better position at this point in time?
Yeah, a more assertive policy about a year ago would have made a massive difference. And here I'm not talking about invading the country. I'm not talking even then. We weren't even talking about airstrikes. But something more assertive earlier would have helped us shape the opposition. I think contain and deal with the battle inside of Syria. Unfortunately, we repeatedly went back to the Russians, begging them for a Security Council resolution that they simply are not ready to sign. For them, the transition is President Assad holds on and runs for re-election in 2014. And that is markedly different than our policy that President Assad has to step aside and we need to move towards a government in Syria that represents the majority and that can stabilize the country.
Let's find out what listeners would like to know. We've got some calls lined up for you. And Abbas joins us from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First, I want to say that I'm a native Arabic speaker. I was born and raised in Iraq. And living under a government ruled by Al-Qaeda is the worst place you want to live. And I've been through that. Second, I've been to Syria in 2010, and yes, I agree, Bashar al-Assad is a dictator, but the Syrians still have a decent freedom. I went to the Mediterranean, women still wear bikini on the sea, on the beach, and it just Syria is just a beautiful country and beautiful people. Now, my question or comment is, once we are helping the rebels and we're not helping Jabhat al-Nusra, but Jabhat al-Nusra is still, in my opinion, is part of the rebels. Even if they didn't put hands on the U.S. weapons that we're providing, after the Bashar is gone, and will Jabhat al-Nusra just sit aside and let the new secular government be? In my opinion, I do not think so. I think they will start bombing, killing, especially the Alawite, the Christians, and the Shia, because they believe these groups are infidels. I've been under Al-Qaeda before, and that's the way they think. And I do not think Syria will see peace with Jabhat al-Nusra inside Syria and other terrorists inside Syria. So if we want to help them, we need to find another way to help them after the fall of the regime into getting rid of these terrorists.
Abbas, thanks for the call. Let's give our guest a chance to respond.
I think that he's exactly right, right? I mean, that first of all, when we talk about backing the rebels, and as the caller recognized, we're not talking about backing the extremists. But it's an important point. There are extremists running around inside of some of the liberated areas of Syria. It's an area that's not under any kind of centralized control. So we need, like, you know, those of you that have watched the film Charlie Wilson's War, remember the end, that after we got rid of the, after we pushed the Soviets out, we didn't go in and try and help those that we backed. Instead, we just backed off. We didn't support those on the ground. We cut off almost all money to the rebels that we helped. And unfortunately, those that filled the vacuum were stepped in and pushed the conflict in a different direction, and it came back to bite us. The caller is exactly right. We're going to need a post-Assad Syria in those areas to isolate those extremist forces. And I think in many cases, we're going to probably have to fight them. That is more of the reason why it's better to understand the opposition, to work with those moderate elements within it, and push the extremists to the side and out of the picture if we can. It's a political operation overall using military means. And if we do it and we learn through doing, we'll be able to guarantee the rights for all Syrians, including those minority populations, which the caller rightly pointed out, are going to be under a lot of pressure if those extremists in Syria come to power.
We have an email here from Derek who says, in April, I visited several refugee camps. The best line I got was from an old man who told me 25% love Assad, 25% hate him, and the remaining 50% are spectators and victims of the tragedy. He says this is a decades-long project. Decades, do you think?
I don't think it's decades long in terms of what we're looking at now. The gentleman is right, and Derek is right in that the problems have been long in making. I think that what we're looking at here is something that's going to take years, certainly. It could take a decade to work out completely. But I think it's one of those situations where it's better if we work it out and if we try and work with what's actually going on in Syria and try and push the different parties into finding a solution, right? And so the way to do that, though, is not by endlessly going to the Russians and begging them for a Security Council resolution that they probably can't enforce anyway. The best bet is through working with the opposition and helping them come together, isolate extremists, and push the Assad regime into a corner. And I think then the Assad regime is going to be much more willing to make the kind of concessions that would see it exiting the scene and keeping Syria in one piece.
Andrew Tabler is our guest, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And we are talking about Syria this hour in light of the G8 conference underway in Northern Ireland right now. And we'd like to hear from you, too. 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 11 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. Taking a look at Wisconsin weather for today, it should be a pretty nice day throughout most of the state. Sunny and mild conditions are forecast. Expect a high in the low to mid-70s. and down to 60s near the Great Lakes. Tonight, though, it is going to be clear and relatively cool for June. Look for lows dropping down into the 40s in parts of Wisconsin. This hour, we are talking about the situation in Syria, particularly in light of the Obama administration's announcement last week that it would be helping arm some of the Syrian rebels there, and the response from Russian President Vladimir Putin. And now both of them are at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland, and Syria very much on the agenda. Our guest this hour is Andrew Taylor, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And among other things, he is the author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Let's head back to the phones right now, and it looks as though Bhaskar is with us from Eau Claire. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I do not agree with your guest regarding the role for United States. I feel that the UN should take a bigger role, and all the other countries should be taken a back seat and look for a political settlement. If we arm the rebels, Russia is going to arm the Syria, that is going to escalate the violence, and there's no a lot of civilians will get killed in the process. That's not what we're looking for. We got to look for a political settlement and give an ultimatum to both the rebels and the Syrians to stop violence, and we should go from there. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And also want to point, we had another call, Ray in Milwaukee, who says this is a fight for Russia and not the U.S. Andrew Taylor, any truth in either one of these two points of view?
Well, we have tried to get the U.N. involved to solve this crisis. We've had two special representatives to Syria, first Kofi Annan, then Lakhdar Brahimi. The problem is it's been hamstrung by the divisions between Russia and the United States over what a transition means. The problem is we've already tried that option as is. And I think that it's unlikely, given what we're seeing coming out of the G8 summit, that the position of Russia and the United States are going to change anytime soon. Quite frankly, we had the Annan plan about a year ago that was designed to get President Assad designed to try and induce its transition. That plan failed miserably. The regime did not pull its forces back from cities, and it did not allow peaceful protests. And then after that, we had Lakhdar Brahimi, the new special representative, has been involved. He's had some very disappointing conversations with President Assad, and President Assad is not ready to come up with that kind of transitional authority that is outlined even by the United Nations. So I think that for the moment, what we need to do is we need to go off and form a coalition to push the Assad regime into a corner. To strengthen the moderates within the Syrian opposition. And then, as I say in my article in Foreign Affairs, at the end of this, we go back to diplomacy, or we keep it open until it works. That could involve the United Nations. It could also involve, we could go outside the United Nations for that. But diplomacy is important in the end to bring about the political settlement that we need in Syria.
And there's no way that, the U.S. has to take that leadership role in your estimation.
The United States has to take that leadership role because, unfortunately, leading from behind or the light footprint policy or whatever they will call it, the problem is, and I think your listeners can understand this, anytime that you let somebody else settle your problems for you, there are differences between what you convey to that person who's settling it for you and what you would like to convey directly. And anytime if we use cutouts like Qatar or Saudi Arabia or Turkey, we shouldn't be surprised that our objectives are not met, and that because those countries have their own interests in the short term and the long term, and they're going to use whatever assistance we give them to further their short term interests. We need to do this directly as Americans. We need to do it safely and smartly. And if we start now, I think there's a chance that we can keep Syria together into one piece and influence the situation there to our benefit. There's a chance. It's not 100%, but we're going to have to learn through doing in Syria, because the Syria conflict, ladies and gentlemen, is not going to go away. We're going to hit the 100,000 mark killed in Bosnia sometime next month. That's you know, which is tragic enough, but that's happened in half the time of Bosnia. And so if you look at the trajectory in Syria, the lack of a political solution thus far, this crisis is going to be coming back to us time and time again. It's better that we deal with it now than waiting for somebody else to deal with it on our behalf.
Tom is with us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
I went to the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and I don't know all the answers, but I think we have to look at it in a different way. Mr. Assad is backed into a corner. He has seen what the Arab Spring has done to all the other dictators. We might get some kind of program with the United Nations or somewhere where we give him safe haven, safe passage, immunity, pay him to get out of there, whatever it costs. He's fighting for himself. That's just one way of looking at it.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Tom says that he's already feeling backed into a corner.
I think he was feeling pretty weak until Hezbollah in the last few months has come in on his side. And I've watched this directly. Hezbollah just crosses the border. They join his forces and his irregular forces there called Shabiha. And they fight alongside each other, and they push the rebels out of certain key towns. And they are backed up by the Iranians as well with economic assistance and other assistance. And now the exchange for that, we believe, was a transfer of sophisticated anti-aircraft systems from Syria to Hezbollah. And I think that's the reason why many of you, the listeners out there, saw that Israel bombed the heights above Damascus not long ago, because a transfer of that type was about ready to take place and the Israelis were laying down their own red line. So I think we're going to be looking at a very difficult situation going forward concerning this matter. I think that Assad is only strong with Hezbollah, and I think his ability to hold on is there, however, with that alliance. The question is, what are we going to do with the opposition to strengthen their hand and to strengthen the hand of moderates?
And one of the things that you've said throughout the hour is that, you know, if we get started now, something good could happen in the future. But it does beg the question, particularly these days, of political will and whether there is that political will that that not only are we willing to do it, but there, you know, there's sort of a unified effort besides the president. Who else is there? And what sort of political will does there need to be to make this happen?
Yeah, well, actually, the president's been having a lot of demands from his own party. If you look very closely, Senator Menendez, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Casey from Pennsylvania, both of those gentlemen, along with a number of others, are asking increasingly pointed questions. How is this going to take place? They realize that the demands for the United States are going up. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this conflict is already costing you a lot of money. Yesterday, they announced that $300 million would be extended to the Syrian opposition, both outside and inside of Syria. That brings the total in the last year to just north of $1 billion, just in dealing with humanitarian and other kinds of assistance that isn't even lethal. So this is already costing you a lot of money, right? The UN will put out a request shortly, and I don't know if it's completely official, but these are the estimates, that they're going to request $4.4 billion from the international community to deal with the Syrian refugees. That's unprecedented. Unprecedented numbers. Ladies and gentlemen, this crisis is coming to us. We're not going to it. We need to deal with it.
Andrew Tabler, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Andrew Tabler has been with us. He is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and his article, Syria's Collapse and How Washington Can Stop It, can be found at washingtoninstitute.org if you'd like to read it for yourself. Bill Martin's produced the hour. Justin Williams provided us with on-air production. Christy Taylor directed the show. And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.